use of poisonous agents in warfare is said to date back at least to 2000 BC in India. But the modern use of what we think of as chemical weapons, poison gas, began in World War I. I just read that early in 1915, the first attempt at use was unsuccessful. On the Russian front, the Germans tried to use poison gas, but it froze out and it wasn't released until spring when the armies were long gone. I don't know if anybody was around. So the first successful use was by the Germans against the French forces in 1915. And the United States and Britain also possessed these weapons, also used them. Variety of different agents, and in fact, there was a corporal in the German army by the name of Adolf Hitler that was victim of a gas attack by the British.
Not enough.
Not enough, but who knows how much of his attitude was formulated from that experience. In 1917, the British also used gas against the Turks in Palestine. And in 1919, against the Bolshevik forces in Russia, when they and the French and we invaded to try to keep the Bolsheviks from getting into power, but weren't able to do that. Reflecting on the situation, in 1919, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded to the German chemist Fritz Haber, who had invented the process for combining nitrogen from the air to form ammonia, which could be the basis for making synthetic fertilizers. Prior to that time, artificial fertilizer had to be obtained from the deserts of Chile. Now there's something else that is made in the same way, and that's explosives for munitions. And World War I at least wouldn't have had the shape it had had Haber not invented that process when Britain and the United States ruled the waves and Germany needed the weapons for what they were trying to do. In his Nobel Prize address, Fritz Haber emphasized the importance not of making artificial fertilizer or gunpowder, but his contributions to poison gas as a means of warfare. He called it a higher form of killing than the severing of flesh, which conventional warfare involved. Now, it was not all that effective, although there were 1 million casualties from gas in the First World War altogether. Only 10% of those were fatalities, whereas other casualties, over a quarter of them ended up being fatal. So as you said, sometimes the dose is not enough. Now, the use did not end with the First World War. In 1925, Spanish forces used poison gas against rebels in Spanish Morocco. In 1934, Soviet forces used it against rebels in Xinjiang province in China. 1935 and 6, Italy against Ethiopia. 37 to 45, Japan against China. And however, in Europe, poison gas was not used in World War II, although both the Axis and the Allies had lots of it, of lots of different kinds, but neither wanted to invite retaliation on the part of the others and withheld first use, withheld total use. But in 1963 to 67, Egypt used it against Yemen, and we'll get to the more recent uses later on. Now, chemical warfare is something that it's a little hard to define as to what the dividing lines are between conventional weapons, chemical weapons, and biological weapons, which I'm not trying to talk about this morning. To the chemist, All materials, including gunpowder and bullets, are chemical in nature, and of course all the effects that you want them to have on human beings are biological effects. But generally we think of poisonous chemicals, which may be deadly, or they may be incapacitating agents or irritating substances like tear gas. They may be either substances of natural origin or synthetic. Warfare or not is important as far as looking at the international agreements that had been signed to prevent the use of specific types of agents in 1925. United Nations General Assembly has voted that the herbicides and the irritant or riot control tear gas type of agents should in fact be prohibited under the Geneva Gas Protocol of 1925, which the United States signed, but as you might guess from the fact we used both of those in Vietnam, we do not agree, or our government did not agree, with the position of the General Assembly. Another case where the distinction between chemical and biological warfare may be somewhat blurred was in the use of toxins from presumably naturally occurring substances like those fungal products that were identified in the so-called yellow rain, which I'll again talk about in more detail in a few minutes. Now, weapons that we define as chemical may attack in various ways, through the eyes, through the respiratory tract, or directly through the skin. The effects can be immediate or lingering for hours, days, weeks, or years, but troops that have adequate warning and protection may have less than 2% casualties, and that was another reason for withholding their use in Europe in the Second World War. The unprepared troops or civilians may have up to 80% killed or permanently out of action, and the remaining 20% temporarily out of action. Protective gear, it has to be very voluminous. It slows down the operations of the troops, reduces the voice communication and the vision by 25 to 50%, makes it hard to eat and sleep while you're wearing the stuff. And above 60 degrees Fahrenheit, it can cause heat prostration after a few hours at most of wearing the full protective gear. So it's best to use those weapons far away from your own troops so that they don't have to protect themselves from the oxymoron-friendly fire of chemical weapons. And there are various ways to release them, all kinds of agents, which I don't think we need to rehearse as far as what their nature or specific effects might be, except to mention that nerve gases were developed first in Germany just before World War II and weren't used for fear the Allies might use them against the German population, much as we used saturation bombing against the German population in the cities. These nerve gas agents are similar in their chemical structure and their biological effects to the organophosphorus type of insecticides, which affect the transmission of nerve impulses. And so if exposure happens and gets through the protective gear, then an antidote is needed to be injected immediately. Of course, if you think you're exposed in art, then you can be severely injured by the antidote if it's not necessary. As far as the involvements of political as well as military potential, directly including United States, the United States charged in 1982 that the Soviet Union had used chemical weapons in Afghanistan, the harassing, the incapacitating, and the lethal chemical agents. They based those charges on reports from rebels and refugees that had made their way to Pakistan, and the symptoms that the victims reported, suggesting various kinds of agents, including nerve agents. But the total roster of symptoms reported couldn't be explained on the basis of any previously known chemical agent. Despite these uncertainties, the United States asserted that at least 3,137 Afghans were killed in chemical attacks, but there was very little physical evidence available. We weren't in any position to go in there ourselves and look for it, and so the manner in which the Soviet gas masks were obtained was always somewhat unclear. One of the accusations made was the use of these naturally occurring toxins from molds that grow on plants, which were given the name yellow rain from the visible appearances reported in Vietnam, where the United States again accused the Soviet of supplying these agents for use in Kampuchea and Laos. It's a complex story, and in fact it took two issues of the New Yorker in February 11th and 18th of this year. Much of the magazine is filled with a very thorough review of the acid rain story, and so I'll only try to give the conclusions as of now. It seems clear that there is no explanation that's adequate for explaining all of the alleged information about yellow rain. But it's also clear that the yellow spots reported, yellow rain.
In the New Yorker.
New Yorker yellow rain, I'm sorry, thank you. Glad somebody was listening, I wasn't. It seems clear that the yellow spots that were reported were actually bee poop. They were full of pollen and other things that, and actually U.S. Scientists went to that area and got sprinkled themselves with this yellow rain and clearly established where those yellow spots came from, at least. Of course, they had no untoward symptoms, as if they had been victims of a chemical warfare attack. The Hmong people refugees that gave the eyewitnesses' account, it's documented in the New Yorker articles that many of those same individuals later denied that what they had said was in fact what had happened. They were desperate refugees who, according to the author, were very likely saying what they thought people wanted to hear in order to give them favorable treatment. So, the United States administration, nevertheless, used very scanty evidence to give repeated charges and pursue them relentlessly in international forums. And the author of these articles at least associates that not only with the general posture of the administration in the early 80s vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, but also that at that time there were efforts in to get Congress to approve a new generation of chemical weapons, and at the end of my presentation I'll rehearse the history of U.S. governmental action in regard to chemical weapons. There can be no question, however, about the use of chemical warfare by Iraq. A United Nations team investigating documented no less than seven different occasions on which Iraq used chemical warfare against Iran. The most serious use, however, couldn't be investigated by the United Nations because, according to international law, apparently it was just an internal issue, the use against the Kurdish population within Iraq at the close of the war against Iran. Neither Iraq nor Turkey would allow United Nations visitors in to investigate. Now, Iraq had signed the Geneva Protocol of 1925, which did not say that you could not develop chemical weapons. It did not say you could not produce chemical weapons. It did not say you could not stockpile chemical weapons. Well, most of the people who signed it placed a further reservation that they would feel free to retaliate if chemical weapons were used against them. But it did agree not to be the first to use them, and clearly Iraq violated that agreement over and over. However, as of 1928, Time magazine was asking, where is the outrage about these uses? At that time, you see, we thought that the enemies of our enemies were our friends, and it was Iran that we had the greatest difficulties with as a result of their holding our people hostage for so long and things of that sort. Europeans also had large financial stakes in Iraq, including providing them with the wherewithal to make a number of these weapons. Estimates of up to 5,000 dying in one city in the Kurdish section of Iraq, how should, one would think, give pause to anyone? There are other estimates that anywhere from 15 to 30 third world nations have chemical weapons. It's referred to as the poor country's atom bomb. And in 1987, a factory in Libya, which was shown to have been built with the help of German corporations, was claimed by the United States to be used for the production of chemical weapons. Libya says, no, we're just making pharmaceuticals there. And in fact, not only the factory, the equipment, but the raw materials can be very much the same for making pharmaceuticals, for making pesticides, or for making nerve gas. So it's difficult to be sure without on-site inspection what's actually going on. Again, in 1990, Iraq used poison gas when some of their military deserters were hiding out in the swamps in southern Iraq, and they couldn't chase them down, so they used gas against them. And they were manufacturing 1,000 tons a year of the poisonous materials and rockets and bombs and artillery delivery systems. And so there was great concern that when the United Nations troops went into Kuwait, that Iraq might use this poison gas against the troops, or, on the other hand, might use it to attack Israel, which was very carefully not a party to that particular action. And the U.S. forces were equipped with elaborate defensive gear, but as we all know, no one used any chemical weapons. There was talk that if they were used on us first, we might use them in return, but there's always the question of whether there is an actual military advantage in a given situation to the use of these that overcomes the difficulties of using them. Since that time, export rules have been adopted to restrict the export of chemicals, equipment, and technical data from the United States that could be used in chemical or biological warfare. That is to restrict this export to specific countries and regions in the Middle East and Southeast Asia, not that we won't sell them to our friends. But again, it's kind of difficult. There are plenty of legitimate uses for maybe many of these chemical raw materials that can be transformed into weapons of chemical warfare. Under the terms of the ceasefire agreement, Iraq is to destroy or all of the chemical weapons in Iraq and missiles that might deliver them to a distances of greater than 93 miles are to be destroyed, as well as any nuclear weapons capability that might be found there. Of course, when and how to destroy those weapons can become a big problem too, and partly the answer will depend on what they are, how much they are, and where they are, whether the process needs to be a quick and dirty one or a slow and clean one that could cost over $100 million, and who's going to pay that. Iraq reported as directed what stocks they had, and the United States said they cheated shamelessly in under-reporting what's actually there, but a UN team this month is supposed to be visiting and determining what the situation is, destroying the missiles, and preparing the plan for destroying the chemical weapons, depending on what they find, as well as their storage and production facilities. And this process could take over a year, and then there are to be continuing on-site inspections under the auspices of the United Nations to be sure that Iraq does not produce more. Well, finally, I would like to rehearse the recent history of United States activities concerning chemical weapons. In 1969, the United States suspended production of chemical weapons, but maintained the stockpiles, both in the United States and in Europe. It wasn't until 1975 that the United States signed the Geneva Convention to agree to no first use. That's just 50 years late. But, of course, under that convention, we're still allowed to develop, manufacture, and store the weapons, and the reservation of feeling free to use them in retaliation was part of that process of signing. But as I say, we hadn't made any since 1969. The administration tried in 1982 to resume production of nerve gas. They said the old stock we have is deteriorating and some could get loose from the weapons and we need to replace it. But this time we're going to do it in a safer way instead of making the nerve gas and storing it that way so that if it gets loose, then there is the hazard to anybody in its way. But we'll make two different ingredients, still toxic, but nowhere near as bad as the nerve gas. Put separate supplies of both ingredients in the bomb or the artillery shell to deliver this gas, and not until that shell has actually been fired or that bomb has actually been dropped will this be mixed together to form the nerve gas. In 1982, the Senate agreed to support the resumption of production of nerve gas and make these so-called binary or two-part weapons, but the House of Representatives turned it down. And there was some question, if you're going to make new kinds of weapons, it seems like probably they ought to be tested. There had been no testing of nerve gas weapons since 1968, when there was a little matter of 6,000 sheep that were killed in Utah from a test that was not properly carried out. Well, the administration kept trying year after year. In 1986, there was a tie vote in the Senate on production, and constitutionally then, the Vice President, George Bush by name, was to break the tie, which was in favor of resuming production. The House of Representatives voted by 210 to 209 against production, and so, of course, then it goes to conference committee. And as part of the compromise on various kinds of arms control amendments prior to the Reykjavik Summit Conference, the agreement was to allow production to begin, but the final combination of the ingredients to be delayed a year or two, that those opposing it thought they could get it stopped the next year or the year after. The General Accounting Office had advised the Congress that there were serious problems in the workability of the Big Eye bomb that would contain these binary weapons, and that better not go ahead too fast until you got a device that had a better chance of working. European governments were agreeable to our producing the weapons, but they didn't want them to be deployed there, and they wanted the existing nerve gas weapons, which after all the administration said weren't safe anymore, said, well, then get them out of here by the early 1990s. But the administration considered that in order to put pressure on to develop an agreement against chemical weapons, it was necessary to enter those negotiations from a position of strength. And in 1987, the Soviet Union shifted their hardline stance against inspection, which seemed to others to be a necessary part of any agreement, not just to trust the parties to keep the agreement. After all, look at what Iraq had already done. There are 40 nations involved in this conference, meeting off and on in Geneva, and they kept at their meetings through 1988. In 1989, various governments and those industries capable of producing the raw materials for these major corporations throughout the world met in Canberra, Australia, to discuss controlling international trade on those agreements, and the chemical industry pledged that they would work with the governments for a chemical weapons treaty as soon as possible. They wanted to be out of the chemical weapons business, too. The General Accounting Office said the Big Eye bomb was still nowhere near ready, and so although Congress authorized $90 million to build production facilities for the new kind of nerve gas in fiscal 1988, the House deleted the funding for actually doing it for fiscal 1989. The U.S. had committed itself to reducing the stocks of chemical weapons by 90% by the year 1997. But President Bush, by that time, wanted to keep producing the weapons again until the global treaty was signed, and then take 8 years to destroy 98% of them, and then keep the other 2% as a deterrent against someone who might not have signed the pact or someone who might not honor the pact. In February 1990, the Pentagon doubled the size of their request for funds to produce chemical weapons and repeated their complaints about alleged Soviet violations of the Geneva Protocol 1925, repeating their charges of Soviet sponsored, at least, use in Laos, Cambodia, and Afghanistan, although said that they had no evidence that any such use had been made after 1984. The next month, March of last year, both Occidental Chemical and Mobay Chemical refused to sell to the United States Army a necessary chemical for producing nerve gas. They said their corporate policy was not to sell chemicals that contribute to proliferation of chemical weapons, not to sell them to anybody unless ordered by Congress to do so. The previous year, the United States had blocked a proposed sale by German manufacturers of that same chemical to Iran. And in fact, it was the Army that wanted to buy it because the Army had to produce their own nerve gas. They couldn't find a major chemical company that would bid on a contract to do that. In June of 1990, President Gorbachev and President Bush signed a bilateral agreement to quit making chemical weapons. This is just 4 months after asking to double the funding for producing them, and agreeing to destroy most of the stocks of chemical weapons both nations have within 10 years. That would get down to a mere 5,000 tons of the active chemical agent for each country. and to keep this agreement in force until it's superseded by a international global agreement, which may have greater restrictions. In July of 1990, the United States began moving the chemical weapons out of Germany. They'd agreed to do that if our artillery shells were removed. They were shipped to Johnston Atoll in the Pacific Ocean, where a plant was under construction and testing to destroy these chemical weapons by burning them at high temperature in a very thorough fashion. Now, the only Soviet facility that was designed to destroy the chemical weapons, which they have agreed to destroy, was closed down because of opposition by local environmentalists. That happens in the Soviet Union these days also. So these chemical weapons remind me of the two-edged sword we were talking about in Revelation earlier this week in Bible study. You've got them. How do you get rid of them? Well, United States says what we're going to do, since they're dangerous to ship, is to set up the facilities for destroying them where they are, which is at various locations, including Umatilla, Oregon. The Pacific nations are horrified at the prospect that we might not, in fact, do that, but might send all of ours over to Johnston Atoll for incineration, contrary to what we had promised. First, that facility would only be used for what was already there, and then we moved the ones from Germany there. And the Germans are saying, well, if it's too dangerous to move them around in your own country, why was it all right to move them through our country? By the way, Johnston Atoll is classified as a national wildlife refuge. So it's yet to be seen how the United States or the Soviet Union will fulfill their obligations mutually agreed to for the destruction of these. Well, the incineration process, the U.S. has decided, is the safest and most effective at absolutely getting rid of the toxic materials, burning it all up. The Soviet Union plant that they're not using because of opposition had a different process of chemical neutralization. That's a much slower process. It makes a whole lot of wastes that are still toxic, although nothing like the nerve gas to begin with, and is very, very costly. But that's what they seem to plan to use. They have proposed two locations to build new plants, but haven't had time to get at doing that yet. But of course, the longer we wait to destroy them, then the greater the danger becomes of leaks from these weapons that were produced back before 1969. And that danger, of course, is far greater if any of that gets loose than any believable dangers from the process of incineration. Well, in November of last year, President Bush vetoed a bill to provide mandatory sanctions against countries that use chemical or biological weapons and against industrial companies that aid in the proliferation of such weapons. The president said that that bill infringed on the presidential authority. Last month, however, President Bush pledged that when a global ban is agreed upon on the possession, production, storage, and use of chemical weapons and enters into force, for the first time, the United States will agree to forswear all potential use. We will agree not to use them to retaliate. We will destroy all of our stocks and not keep that 2% held back. And those had been two of the biggest roadblocks in reaching the international agreement in Geneva. The only remaining serious problem is how these challenge inspections are to be carried out. And a target date has been set of next May, and our administration has proposed the conference remain in continuous session to meet that target date. And so at least for my last session here at Holden Village, I feel there I do have some good news to present. Well, unfortunately, I've been doing all the talking up to this point. Surely there is some ideas, complaints, concerns that you folks have on the issue, or you wouldn't have honored me with your presence here. Yeah, it's the Pacific Ocean countries that are concerned about it. Australia's agreed that incineration of what's there is probably the best thing to do, and they won't try to prevent that, but they're very much opposed to shipping our whole stock over there. It's countries like the Federated Republic of Micronesia. And in fact, U.S. senators from Hawaii and representatives have spoken very strongly against it. They say, we live in around with the Pacific Ocean around it. We use its waters. It must not become the dumping ground. Of course, compared to the nuclear tests that the French still carry out there, this is probably number two on their concerns. But there are people who live downwind. There just aren't powerful nations. Of course, prevailing winds and don't always prevail, too.
I'm not for burning.
Yeah, well,
at Johnson Island, but,
I do not have the facts on the questions that are being raised. I'm very grateful for your knowing more about it than I do as far as those specifics. Of course, I do know that conventional air pollutants travel thousands of miles, that actually air pollution from the United States has been tracked to Europe. So being a few hundred miles away would not be enough to keep people from getting awfully nervous. And of course, a lot of it is fear of the unknown. You don't really understand what these are. You don't know how effective the incineration process is. You don't know whether 99.99% destruction is enough so you don't need to worry about the rest of it or not. And you also don't like big kids on the block kicking you around.
I agree with you. I wasn't trying to...
Oh, yeah. I wasn't arguing with you either. I was just...
We should get in trouble with South America either.
Yeah. I haven't heard of objections from South America. Of course, that's quite a bit farther east than Hawaii is. Okay, it's an arbitrary definition. Biological weapons to me would imply that something which is alive, a virus or a bacillus or I guess anthrax is transmitted by spores, and a disease is actually being used, whereas chemical, it's a kind of molecule which gives an effect on the receiving organisms, whether it's us or the mangroves of South Vietnam. Now, when the agent allegedly used is something that is derived from plant material like the alleged yellow rain, then the definition gets a little bit blurred. And if the defoliants were considered to be biological warfare rather than chemical, then we would be in violation of a biological weapons treaty to which we were a party, which bans possession as well. But since they weren't aimed directly for the purpose of killing or incapacitating troops or population, calling them chemical weapons becomes a matter of arbitrary definition too. And as I recall what I said, it was that we in the United Nations General Assembly have different opinions on that matter of legal definition. So it all it's whatever the treaty says it is, I guess.
Separate or?
The molecule gets completely destroyed. The carbons come out as carbon dioxide, the hydrogens as water, the chlorines as hydrochloric acid, and the sulfurs as sulfur dioxide, the phosphorus, ultimately phosphoric acid. And these are, shall I say, conventional air pollutants. Or, of course, the carbon dioxide and water aren't air pollutants per se at all. So it would just be if the fire wasn't hot enough or the material wasn't in it long enough to become completely destroyed. And of course they will have the best possible pollution control equipment on those incinerators as well to catch anything that might get loose. So I would say that from the outside, it looks as if that probably is the best bet.
What about the Russian method? What would they use to neutralize?
Well, it would be a chemical reaction to change the deadliest chemicals into things that were less deadly by breaking the molecules into smaller pieces, but not completely chewing them up. Well, they're doing it, I think, along in a lot of water, so at that point, it's not feasible to incinerate it, and I'm not sure. I haven't seen any details on that process as to what really does come out, but U.S. scientists that looked at the Russian plant that they're not going to use said this is 1950s technology, as far as we're concerned. Yeah?
There was a lot of scare about the Iraqis possibly using chemical mm-hmm. weapons in their missiles. Was that something they were technically really capable of doing?
Well, I think we had every reason to believe they were. We knew they had missiles. We knew they had chemical weapons. I think it was artillery shells that rather than long-distance missiles that they were actually using against Iraq and against their own people, but because they were closer. But we would also be concerned about that. It was only Israel that it would take a long-range missile to reach.
So you think they probably could have done that if they wanted to?
I believe they probably could have done that if they wanted to. It's just my personal opinion. I know inside information on the subject. But I suspect that they also believed that we were quite ready to retaliate if they did and if we chose to. And actually it turned out that they didn't seem to be able to do or try to do, and I'm not sure on that one either, a whole lot of what we were expecting them to do in any regard. Except they did promise to light the oil wells on fire, and they did keep that promise. But it may well have been like the World War II situation. Both sides had them and knew the other side had them, and just wasn't worth it to try to use them.
Well, since you brought it up then, what is your perspective on those oil well fires?
Well, my perspective on them is that it is just part of incredible environmental desolation that's been inflicted on that part of the world. That the calculations of the possibility of a nuclear winter type phenomenon are not taking place. There's enough evidence to show that that is not happening, that the fires are not close enough together to produce enough heat to get the smoke clear up into the stratosphere, which is what it takes to spread it all around the world. They are getting black snow in Kashmir, but not in the Cascades. Now, there is still the possibility that the total amount of that smoke plus all the extra dust and sand that is stirred up by the military operations could affect the path of the monsoons, so that either the rain might come more in the Indian Ocean and less in Africa and Asia, which depend on these once a year rains, or that the monsoon might actually fail. But it had already been predicted that it would be a poor year for the monsoon before the actual fighting ever broke out. So if the rains don't come, there will be no way to know whether that is part of the reason or not. If the rains do come, then we'll know that didn't prevent them. And have a tape on the subject available from last week if you want to hear more about the subject.
I'm interested about third world countries you brought up, that that's a third world atom bomb. Are they producing it? Are they buying it? Do they have the technology to contain it?
Well, according to a couple years ago, after the Iraqi use, they produced that. Iran had, they believe, the capability, of course, equipment as well as chemicals being bought abroad. Libya, we claim they're doing it. They claim they aren't. Syria. North Korea, Vietnam, and Afghanistan have all been reported as having chemical weapons. And Burma, China, Egypt, Ethiopia, Israel, Somalia, and Taiwan suspected of having them. And of course, there's a long list of nations that, not that long, but a dozen or so, that are considered either to have or have the capability or be able to develop the capability of producing nuclear weapons. And this is much easier to do than that is. So I think there's no doubt that either begging, borrowing, stealing, buying, or homemade chemical weapons will be available to many countries unless an effective global treaty there with inspections can be brought about.
Is there a mass antidote? For instance, if someone puts chemical agent in, can you put a rocket with an antidote against it? And, I mean, is that a direction?
I haven't seen any speculation in that direction. As far as antidotes, it's a matter of quickly injecting the individual. Of course, the best thing is covering up and having the air that you breathe protected to the point it doesn't get to you. But of course, if it's a civilian population, Israel tried to provide protection for the population, but that would be a kind of a special case. Larger countries and poorer countries wouldn't be able to do that.
Could this be transported? Could that be a terrorist kind of thing?
Absolutely.
Could that be transported in something small enough to be released in a crowded area or something?
Oh, absolutely, and especially a suicide mission such as we've seen with the bombs all over the world. No doubt but what that could be highly effective. And of course, if the person you are terrorizing believes that you will do it, that may be as effective as actually doing it.
Where do you see it going, Bill? We're in, it seems to me, in terms of chemical weaponry, we're in the early stages still.
Mm-hmm.
We've now got smart bombs, if you want to run parallelisms, mm-hmm. with more, quote, conventional weaponry. We've now got smart bombs, and we're relying on the fact that we can break through bunkers or break through buildings and blow out particular segments mm-hmm. that we wish to. We're going to do the same thing with chemical weaponry?
Well, I see chemical weaponry as being ahead of either conventional or nuclear as far as international negotiations. That we have indicated a willingness to get out of it completely, and we have not indicated a willingness to get out of any other kind completely. The Soviet Union similarly has indicated that willingness. And whether the smaller nations will go along with it or not, any use they would make against a major power, the major power would have plenty of other resources to retaliate with without having to retaliate in kind, they would think. So I see this picture as more favorable than any other.
Okay.